the Coastal Cafe. I'm Aaron Barnett, your host today. Coastal Cafe is a joint production of Washington Sea Grant at the University of Washington's College of the Environment and KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend. Today, our guest is Sarah Brace, the Executive Coordinator for the Pacific States British Columbia Oil Spill Task Force. Welcome, Sarah.
Thanks, Aaron. It's great to be here.
So, you know, the obvious question is, well, what is the Pacific States British Columbia Oil Spill Task Force? I guess we can start off with that.
Yeah. Well, first off, it's a huge mouthful. It's hard to say in rapid fire. So, we're an organization that was formed back in 1988, and the history kind of explains our existence. Many of you listeners may recall back in 1988, there was an oil barge named the Nestucca that was traveling up the Oregon coast and hit a storm and collided with its tug along the Washington coast. And this resulted in a spill of about 250,000 gallons that was transported by currents and tides up along the Washington coast, up to British Columbia, partway up the Vancouver Island shoreline. And it brought together the governor of Washington and Premier BC in recognizing how kind of ill-prepared this transboundary region was for a spill of this size and magnitude, and that there really wasn't a lot of great coordination and collaboration between the states on our side of the border as well as across the border. And so that kind of led to the formation of the seedling organization called the Pacific States Task Force on Oil Spills, started by the governor of Washington at the time and the premier of BC at the time. And the two jurisdictions sort of started down the pathway of like lessons learned from that Nestucca spill. What can we do better next time? Where are there gaps in our policy and planning preparedness? And then about a year later, almost to the date after that Nestucca incident, after the first kind of annual meeting of this little new task force, the Exxon Valdez spill occurred up in Prince William Sound. And that prompted Alaska, California, Oregon, and California to join the task force. And Hawaii became a member in 2001. And so really what we are is a coalition of Western states and British Columbia who are united in efforts to prevent and respond to oil spills across the West Coast. So for the past 30 years or so, we engage with federal, state, provincial, and tribal governments, First Nations, industry, environmental organizations, and so on, to advance prevention and preparedness across the West Coast with regard to oil spills. So it's a pretty big mission. You know, our kind of true mission as an organization is to have no spilled oil. That's our vision statement. And our mission is to work together to improve the Pacific Coast prevention, preparedness, and response and recovery from oil spills. So that's kind of why we exist and what we've been doing for 30 years.
Mm-hmm. Who are some of the federal partners you guys work with?
Well, back in 2011 or 12, I believe it was, we formed an MOU with the U.S. Coast Guard. And the reason for that was that really since its inception, the task force has worked closely with the Coast Guard, with NOAA, with EPA, with a number of, I would say key federal partner would be the Coast Guard, since most of our domain has been historically the marine side of the kind of the environment. And so in EPA in some regard. So those our sort of body of partners has expanded over the years because we've worked closely with U.S. Fish and Wildlife if there's kind of a wildlife issue. I'll point out that we don't actually show up at spills. The Oil Spill Task Force is not a response entity. We don't kind of come in and try to help because that's not our skill set. We let the states or the province or the feds deal with kind of the response, and clean up technology and needs that happen. But we're there to sort of glean lessons learned, understand what happened, who are the parties involved and what was impacted, and essentially try to glean what their lessons learned from this incident. Is there a way in which we can take this and help promote some form of best practices or even some policy to help change the direction of things. One thing I will point out is the Pacific States BCLS Bill Task Force was really a backbone to the very first federal policy around oil spills called the Oil Spill Open 90, Oil Spill Prevention Act of 1990. And that's kind of akin to sort of the Clean Air Act or the Clean Water Act. It's the Oil Pollution Act that is a federally mandated law across the nation. And those early founding members of the task force went to Congress and testified regarding the Exxon Valdez and kind of what went awry there and how necessary and really important it was to develop some federal policy. So as you can sense, this organization has had quite a lot of engagement with the federal partners through the years. But in terms of our MOU that ties us all together, we're really made up of the state agencies that respond to oil spills and the BC agency that responds to oil spills or prepares for and responds to oil spills.
So speaking of OPA 90, is there any way you can encapsulate the before and after policies and actions and response abilities today as compared to before that act?
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty beefy act. So I think I can just touch on a few. Some of the changes that came about were regarding, you know, escorts of vessels in near shore or near waterways or harbors and kind of coastal areas. A double hauling of vessels. There was a requirement in OPA 90 that all vessels had to be double hauled by, I believe it was 2012, 2015, perhaps. There was requirements around, you know, pilotage, around all the sort of operational aspects of movement of oil on water that I can't remember all the details off the top of my head. But for the most part, it really transformed kind of how prepared we would be for spill through the requirements of having, you know, drills and exercise be required. So you practice getting your boom and your equipment out on the water and drill it and make sure it works. So there's quite a lot of prevention as well as response directives that came out of that. So super powerful act. I'll leave it there.
I was wondering, you know, if it's possible, if you're comfortable, walking us through the steps that would happen if there is, say, a major spill, say, in Washington State, for example, say, 500,000 gallons. What would happen from the time that was reported? What does that look like?
If it's on coastal marine waters, and in the waterways, that's primarily the jurisdiction of the Coast Guard. If it happens on land, that would be kind of the jurisdiction of the EPA. And what that means is that those would be the lead agencies who would be the kind of the leaders of the response. And so when that happens, incident command is set up where you have a collection of leadership from the Coast Guard, from the state, from the responsible party, the ship, the owner of the company involved, that the incident command doesn't involve the responsible party, but involves the decision-making tree of the federal government and the state entities and the other trustee agencies that would be impacted. So organizations that manage the resource would be involved as well in this kind of response situation and setup. And then from there, there's a very prescribed incident command handbook that describes exactly the steps that are taken to map out a response. I don't have those steps memorized, but that's really because I don't show up at a spill. I'm less involved in the mechanics of how the response takes place. But the leadership have constant briefings on, you know, where all this moving, what's the status of the shoreline, what's the status of the vessel, and then there's, you know, a prescribed, very detailed approach to responding to that information in a unified command manner. And so the responses really can take, you know, hours, days, and particularly on site. It's very intense. It's not a place where someone who's not deeply involved in the incident command team would be to witness or watch. You really kind of keep people off to the side to make sure no one's getting in the way of you know, cleaning up this hazardous material. But yeah, there's, I don't show up at spills because that's not where I made it or wanted. It's more of the prescribed and very, very thorough response system that's set up through the, you know, the Coast Guard and the state agencies that are the lead responders.
Mm-hmm. And in Washington, what state agencies would get involved with this bill?
So the Washington State Department of Ecology spills program is the, you know, the lead state agency in response. So they're always poised and on call and ready for responding if there's a call. But, you know, DNR would, if it's in an area of significant resources that would be those resource agencies like Department of Natural Resources that may have the tideland waters and, you know, shellfish areas, those kind of areas that need protection. Tribal governments are certainly involved in protecting their resources and they're engaged. Which primarily the marine and shoreline coastal agencies and governments would be there to, you know, participate.
Speaking of tribal interests, is there still a response tug up at Nia Bay?
Yes. Yeah. That was established a number of years ago by the legislature, and it is now there and has been funded now by industry, meaning the companies that move vessels through Puget Sound and pay into a kind of a fund that pays for that tug escort, that emergency towing vessel that's stationed up at Nia Bay. That's right.
So there's somebody, so it's manned or they're ready to go at any moment's notice.
Ready to go. Exactly. At any time. Hmm. Yeah.
Has it been used in any substantive way?
It's been used over the years. You can actually go on the Washington Department of Ecology's spill program website, and there's a link there to the emergency towing vessel record, and you can see what it's been used for in the recent months or years. I mean, it's not there just for the big and ugly spills, but if there's a, you know, if there's a fishing boat in distress, it'll go help it out. If there's, you know, any kind of opportunity they can provide support, they will. I don't know more about the kind of day-to-day usage of it, but it is there and it is available for particularly any major incidents.
So have there been any major spills within the task force, you know, states and areas in the last couple of years or a few years that you can comment on?
One of the areas that we're really in the marine environment, you know, we're doing relatively well. You know, there's a lot of really excellent best practices and standards of care taking place to ensure marine fuel movement is, you know, in its most safest way possible. There's always risks, but that risk has now really shifted inland, where we're seeing a lot of rail cars moving oil up and down the West Coast, you know, coming in from the interior of the country out along the Columbia River and up to refineries and Anacortes or down to towards Oregon and then California. And that's where, you know, we've seen a couple rail derailments that have been quite alarming. One in Moser, Oregon, a couple years ago. And then most recently up in Whatcom County, there was a oil car derailment that, you know, resulted in significant spillage in both of them and, you know, significant risk or in Moser, there's quite a lot of damage to the local environment and the community there. So you know, we actually as an organization kind of look out into the kind of horizon and see, you know, where is the spill risk, you know, the greatest, and how can we help support our states and the province of BC in mitigating that risk, whether it's through helping develop policy and legislation or helping develop best practices that can be implemented by industry on a voluntary basis so you don't have to kind of push that long, heavy regulatory log uphill. And that's, you know, that's the kind of thing where we sort of keep an eye out for and try to engage as a organization to be a voice from this West Coast on our concerns for those kinds of risks.
So if you're just joining us, this is KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, and I am Aaron Barnett, today's host, Coastal Cafe. We're speaking with Sarah Brace, Executive Coordinator for the Pacific States British Columbia Oil Spill Task Force. While risk is actually something that I just realized would be interesting to talk about, for example, how is risk, oil spill risk, assessed in Washington? Because most of our listeners are obviously in Washington.
Right.
But could you speak to that?
That's a great question. Most of the listeners have probably heard about the expansion of the Trans Mountain pipeline up in British Columbia and the resulting increase in oil that will be moved through the Salish Sea from vessels transporting that pipeline crude offshore to export or to domestic locations. And so what typically happens is there's something called a risk assessment study that would be carried out. And these have been done periodically in the Puget Sound region. And then most recently, I know that the British Columbia, the Kinder Morgan pipeline, sponsored a study up there of looking at the risks of increased vessel traffic and the likelihood of incidents. And so those kinds of studies are really looking at everything from the amount being moved, the volumes being shipped, the geography of the landscape of where these ships are moving through, the areas of high risk, Haro Strait, and there's areas within the San Juans in the Georgia Strait area that have elevated risk just because of the way the tides work and the geography. Mm. So those risk assessments are really a great tool in the hip pocket of regulators or, legislators, agencies that are trying to prepare for anything that could go wrong. And so having a risk assessment study really gives you a good picture of where and when and how those risks are measured and described. And those result in recommendations such as, adding additional escort tugs for certain parts of the Salish Sea where there is higher risk, or making sure that vessels are anchoring in certain areas where they're less likely to run aground. Or there's numerous sort of recommendations that spin out of those risk assessment studies that often become implemented as best practices or spun off into some kind of legislation.
So between British Columbia and Washington, there's been a lot of new talk on risk to the southern killer whale residents. Southern resident killer whales.
Killer whales, yeah.
And how has the task force addressed that work and industry? I want to include industry as well, obviously.
We're primarily providing as a resource of information on that work. We're not actually involved in those studies. Okay. However, we're one of the things I'll say that the task force, does as kind of one of our driving mission, goals is to sort of be a resource and be continuing to keep an eye out for new and emerging technology, new and emerging research and studies, such as the orcas, the whale populations and vessel strikes, new and emerging fuels and oils, how are they being processed? What's their impact to the environment? That sort of thing. We don't actually do those studies per se, but we provide kind of a conduit to get that information out to our partners, our member agencies, and whoever else might be interested through workshops, through our annual meetings, through our website. It's sort of a turnstile of information. But ultimately, I like going to those workshops and learning more about the ways in which, for example, the Port of Vancouver has really been a leader in initiating kind of slowing down vessels through main whale corridors and really making sure that they, understand where the priority usage areas are of those animals and making sure that the vessels are abiding by the slowdown request. And so that it's just interesting to see that those studies have been really favorable in showing that it works. And so it's important to get that message out to other bays and harbors and ports, is that, hey, they're doing this stuff in Vancouver, you guys should try it down in, you know, Port of Humboldt or wherever else there may be an incidence of whale strikes.
So a lot of information sharing. So since this COVID-19 pandemic is hopefully running, I was wondering how the COVID-19 pandemic has impacted task force operations, if at all.
Yeah, no, great question. Essentially, all of the task, all the agencies that we work with, I mean, everybody shut down, right? I mean, nobody was going to the office. No one was going to work. Very few people were, going through their daily jobs out in the field, you know, except for, of course, emergency responders and those who could show up if an incident happened, they would be there. But really what had happened was it forced us and many organizations to, you know, obviously pivot quite quickly to the virtual platform for meetings, for engagements, for workshops, for those kinds of, ongoing work. But it also posed challenges for, you know, doing oil spill drills or exercises. And how do you do those virtually? And how do you get agencies like, you know, federal agencies and state agencies and local governments that all use different platforms to be able to communicate on a drill or on an exercise? And I think kind of a silver lining, which in my opinion is that this kind of forced the issue of like getting platforms that everyone can participate on is a good thing to do anyway. Like this is good to kind of offer up an opportunity to say, wow, we do struggle trying to connect in the virtual world and we may need to do more of this in the future. And having remote response capability involves being able to all communicate on a similar platform. And so mm-hmm. it really forced that into play. And I think there are a lot of really creative kind of structures and opportunities that came out of that, like using Adobe Connect and Teams and having a way to sort of have multiple platforms perhaps concurrently working, but having lots of training. And that was the other thing we learned a lot about this year, was that you can't just kind of throw up platforms and have people join. You've got to have a good training session, have people there to help people navigate through the systems. But we learned a lot about really cool drills and exercises, and even some responses that utilized drones, utilized offsite, providing direction and guidance offsite versus those that would have shown up and been there in person, and it could work. It wasn't it wasn't as if it was challenging situations made it impossible. It forced folks to come up with new and creative ways to get the job done. So that's neat, because I've been hearing that, you know, many of those things will continue on even past COVID, that in some cases, you know, virtual drills or virtual meetings and workshops or virtual observations can work. And it may even be easier than getting bodies moving around the country in a very quick place.
Well, that leads me to the question I have here on my list of questions, number 6, actually, and I was just wondering, what are some things we can look forward to seeing from the task force in the near future?
Yeah, we're thinking a lot about new fuels and what's coming on the horizon. Down in California, for example, our task force member down there has been telling us a lot about the kind of shift over from conventional to biofuels. Some of the refineries are rejiggering their systems to process, plant material and other to biofuels. And so now there's the question of, well, how do you respond to those? How do they behave in the water? Do they sink? Do they float? You know, what are the response needs for dealing with a spill of, you know, a diesel where you have no idea like what type of biodiesel it is, because it's not as stringently classified perhaps, or as categorized as some other more conventional fuels. So that's kind of a newbie for us, is sort of thinking about What are the needs? What is the science that's needed? Is anyone doing that science? Is there anyone out there actually doing fate and effects modeling of these compounds? And sort of that's what I do, is sort of look around and find where's information exist and who's doing what, and that bringing that to the task force members and having an opportunity to kind of discuss, like, what does that mean for these oil spill programs where they're funded, for example, by a per barrel tax. Well, maybe that per barrel tax doesn't apply to biofuels because there's some incentive, you know, to get those materials produced and created. So we're starting to see agencies questioning their ability to, perhaps not their ability, but their funding mechanism to respond to things where they're not actually, supported through the revenue stream of that, you know, traditional way. So that's kind of one area. We're also really deeply involved in trying to push abandoned derelict vessel prevention forward. We spent a couple of years designing a big kind of model program for ADVs, as we call them, and how do you prevent them? How do you get them dealt with and managed and pulled out of the water and recycled? And how do you set up policy around, you know, insurance and registration and those kinds of structures to help track and monitor and ultimately maybe prevent these things from happening? Because they're a huge, huge expense for, you know, most of the states I work with, and even BC up in Canada, they have obviously an abandoned derelict vessel issue up there as well. But we're really trying to figure out how to get the piece now we're really struggling with is paying for them. Once the hazardous materials pulled off, it becomes a challenge. Sometimes they just continue to exist with the oil pulled off, but nobody owns it. No one has the money to pull it out, and they sit in the shoreline for years and years. So that's another area we're working. Yeah.
The gift that keeps on giving, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So we got a couple more minutes left. Is there anything you'd like to add, Sarah, before we sign off?
No, I think it's, we have a website with great information on it that talks a lot about our work and our projects. We try to engage the public through our public meetings and we do a big annual meeting every year where we share out kind of the work we're doing. And then we kind of grab a couple topics that we're interested in and bring in the experts, bring in industry, bring in partners to talk about it. So we're sort of a we're trying to keep the dialogue going and always welcome questions and input from the public.
Oh, great. Well, thank you all for joining us. This is Aaron Barnett, and you've been listening to Coastal Cafe, and our guest has been Sarah Brace, Executive Coordinator of the Pacific States British Columbia Oil Spill Task Force. Coastal Cafe is a joint production of Washington Siegert at the UW College of the Environment and KPTZ 91.9 FM. Washington Sea Grant helps people and marine life thrive by providing research, technical expertise, and education that support the conservation of our ocean coastlines. I'd like to thank our program director, Larry Stein, and production engineer, Jared Dufresne. As always, a special shout out to the band Kiwis for sharing their music with us at the opening and closing of this program. Thank you for listening and have a great day. Ah.